the cab driver, this is years ago, the cab driver. Oh, you mean the Greek embassy? Can see no the academy. Well, they got Greek letters all over the front of it.
That's great.
So
I think we're all right. I just want to make sure that everything is working. Okay. I guess we're ready to begin then. Let me just indicate that today is Friday, June 21st, 1991, and this is Jim Boning talking with Dr. Frederick Wall at his home in La Jolla. Dr. Wall, I know you were born on December 14th, 1912 in Chisholm, Minnesota.
That's correct.
Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Well, yes. My parents were both born in Finland and emigrated to the United States around the turn of the century. As a matter of fact, my father came, I think, about a year before my mother, to find a place, so to speak, and as a great many of the Finnish immigrants at that time did, they went to the northern tier of states, northern Minnesota, northern Michigan, some went to New England, but northern Minnesota resembles Finland in terms of the nature of the trees, the woods, the a soil that is not given to luscious agriculture, but where you have to work hard to make a living. But it was the kind of thing they were used to. Actually, my father was not a farmer. He was a baker. He had, I guess his father had been a miller, working, I don't know whether he owned it or not, but a little mill where they would make flour out of grain and things like that. So he came to this country and settled in Minnesota in the village of Chisholm, which had a sizable Finnish community. In fact, a number of the towns on the old Mesaba Range have a great many Finns. They went there as a place to get started, not because the jobs available were what they liked, but it would give a way of going on. For example, there were mining jobs opening. The Minnesota iron mines were excellent. They had wonderful ore and so on, now largely depleted, you understand, but at that time it was burgeoning, and they were really had lots of jobs. So a great many immigrants went there, including the Finns, who went not because they liked mining, that's not their inclination, but it was a job to get started, and their aspirations generally were to get a tract of land and run their farm or something. Well, it didn't necessarily work out that way. Their children in second and third generation got assimilated and were encouraged to go to school and things like that. So I was the last of six children. My two oldest siblings, a sister and a brother, were actually born in Finland, and the other siblings and myself were born in this country. The eldest of the family, sister, was just died last year, last December. She was well long over 90 by now. And I was the youngest of the family, and I'm the only survivor at this time. So that very briefly is some of the background. A lot of people ask, where'd you get your name? Because if they know anything about names, they'd say Wall is not a Finnish name, and indeed it is not. They say, what was it changed from? Well, it wasn't changed. That was my father's name there. And only relatively recently did I, three years ago, I guess, did I learn about the origin of it. Do you mind my telling you about that sort of thing? I have a distant cousin who's actually a professor of Latin at the University of Helsinki. And his father had corresponded with my father, and they had very vague sort of, they knew about us and so on, and his son was going to Caltech as a graduate student, and he hoped that we would see him and that kind of thing. And so I learned from his son nature of how we got our name. Well, it turns out that one of our forebears, and I forgot how many generations back, had been a drill sergeant in the Finnish Army. And the commander, who was probably a Swede at that time, because Finland was for a long time a part of Sweden, said he didn't want those long Finnish names, polysyllabic names particularly. And every non-com had to have a name that had some military significance. So this forebearer of mine suggested that he adopt the name Vallitus. Vallitus meaning in Finnish a parapet. That seemed to be good, kind of a wall. In fact, that's coincidental. But the commander says Vallitus. Well, yeah, but that's still too long. Why don't you make it Vallo? And it is spelled with a W, understand? And indeed, the name became Vallo. That's the the Finns don't like words that end in L. In general, they don't like words that end in consonants except S and N. For example, Finnish names you may see like in N left and so on. They'll end any N. If you see that at the end, that's probably a Finnish name, any N. Also, S can end it, but L never. What they say, my Finnish friends, my parents' Finnish friends would say, Valli. They have to put a consonant on the end. They would say Valli instead of Vol or Wall, as where the simply pronouncing is the way we would do it, but without a change in the actual spelling. From, well, that's the story of our name. And you know, I was glad to learn about that, because people so often ask me, and they'd say, well, what's the matter with this guy? Doesn't he know how he got his name? You know, and so on. Look, that doesn't sound like a Finnish name. It must be made up. And well, it wasn't. Actually, my father was substantially monolingual. Didn't go through high school, I don't believe, or the equivalent. My mother was bilingual, as so many Finns were at that time, both Finnish and Swedish being official languages. And she did speak Finnish as well as English. Swedish as well as Finnish, I beg your pardon. But her name was a typical Finnish name. Her last name was Rauhala. That's typical Finnish. Well, that's a very brief background with regard to...
That's excellent. Did you grow up in Chisholm then?
Well, until I was, what was it, about 8 years of age, yeah, I'd gone through third grade in Chisholm. Then we moved to Minneapolis. My father retired. Seemed kind of premature and by today's standards, but he was getting along. You understand I was the youngest and so on, but I still... well, he didn't quit activity entirely, but then he got involved in real estate. He bought houses and rebuilt them and rented them and that kind of thing. Not a very highly remunerative thing, but it did keep him busy and it provided some income. Moreover, our oldest, the oldest child, was going to the University of Minnesota and thought, okay, we'll live in Minneapolis and that'll be a good place for the kids to go to school, because my parents did encourage us to go to school, though we didn't get the kind of counseling you would get, you know, from experienced counselors who didn't have the academic background. Still, my father always felt, and my mother certainly felt, that, look, these kids better learn all they can, and that is so we went to Minneapolis, and there I went to finished up grade school, high school, and I went on to the University of Minnesota.
Did all of your brothers and sisters go to University of Minnesota?
Well, yes, my oldest brother went to Carleton College for a while, but he did not finish up. But then my other brothers did. Then I had a younger, my older sister, the one who just died last year, went to the University of Minnesota. Two of my brothers did, got degrees there, and I, as a matter of fact, one of my brothers got a PhD from Minnesota as well. And I had another younger sister who died when she was still relatively young of a heart condition that wasn't clear at the time, or at any rate, I never really got precisely what was wrong. So she never reached the age. She died when she was 18. She did not reach the age to go to college because she hadn't yet even finished high school. She was in bed for quite a while there, and so
you had quite a precedent ahead of you in terms of.
Oh yes, yes. And as a matter of fact, life was harder for the older ones. And I profited from their experience and from the realization that, and I suppose to a certain degree, some my older brothers thought I was being favored because parents were doing for me things they hadn't done for them, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that is certainly true, and yet it reflected the fact that as a result of the experience, the readjustment, the realization to how things are done, it was easier for me.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any teachers in grade school or high school that had an influence on you?
I'm sure they all, to varying degrees, some had influence, but if you were to say any that had a profound influence, no really impact that I can identify and say, yes, that set me on a certain course. The I would say this, that looking back, I did not get any scholarly orientation through counseling in high school. You know, Fred, do you want to go to college? Yes. Well, that's fine. Yes. So what are you interested in? Well, I thought I was interested in chemical engineering. Well, that's mighty nice. Good words to that effect, you know. And got to aim high. They might have figured that maybe I would be lucky if I ended up with just an ordinary, mundane job. Actually, I don't know why necessarily that feeling prevailed on the part of then, because I was a good student. I was not the top of the class in high school, though I was on the honor roll. I was top probably in elementary school. We lived in often university, but in high school, which had a bigger area, there were a number of students who came from the university community. And our high school district overlapped where we lived and the university community. The university community kids had it all over us in terms of sophistication and realization that, hey, there are things that can be done, things that hadn't been pointed out to me. And this is not the fault of my parents. They didn't know. They encouraged, one to get on. But they weren't going to say, hey, why don't you go and get a PhD or something like that, because my parents probably didn't know what a PhD was, see. Mm-hmm. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying they're unintelligent. No. That just wasn't a part of their life, see. And in high school, I didn't get this kind of, hey, why don't you apply for this or apply for that? It was rather, well, it's nice if you go ahead and do this sort of thing. Then my older sister and her husband's a lawyer who actually went into academic work, and ultimately they ended up in University of North Carolina. But they encouraged me and provided an insight into goals that might be achieved, you see. And then I had a stirring of saying, hey, I'm not going to settle for something, you know, just ordinary. I want to see if I can't make more of it. I went to the University of Minnesota ostensibly to study chemical engineering.
How did you develop that interest?
Well, I was interested in chemistry.
Was that through your high school?
Through high school, yes. I was interested in chemistry. I was interested in mathematics. I always had a knack for mathematics, and even as a child, perhaps what I loved most was geometry. I just lapped it up. I like deductive systems, and if somebody says, why don't you become a mathematician, I says, what does a mathematician do? I mean, people would have said that. Back in those days, you know, unless you said, hey, you can become a professor someday, that thought never occurred to me. I had to get a job. I knew what it meant to make a living. And I says, all right, chemical engineering. I like chemistry more, but engineers get jobs. Chemists are, though I wouldn't have said it at the time, are more esoteric, you see, that kind of thing. So that was the practical way of dealing with something that related to something I liked. Mm-hmm. You get the feeling?
Sure.
However, by the end of my, happily, at the University of Minnesota, the curriculum for chemistry and chemical engineering was identical in the first year. In other words, you took the same thing. Then the second year, you took one course in chemical engineering just as sort of an introduction to something, otherwise it was identical. And the third year, things began to split apart, and chemists went more for pure science, and the chemical engineers went the other. By the end of the first year, I says, hey, you know, I don't have to stay in this chemical engineering curriculum. It isn't going to cost me any time, money, or anything. Same thing. I think maybe I want to go into chemistry. In the second year, continued the program, and I did take this very brief course in chemical engineering, which is extra. It didn't cost me anything in terms of effort or time. I didn't have to supplant something else. And I was persuaded that, no, it's not chemical engineering for me. It's going to be chemistry. So my junior year, I switched my curriculum from chemical engineering to chemistry and lost no time. And let me say, this is important, because notwithstanding the encouragement I got, it didn't mean that I could just fool around and be a dilettante at the young age and shift from here to there. I could make that shift without postponing getting on with a job or getting my education.
Mm-hmm.
And in my junior year, by then I had already decided that someday I was going to get a PhD.
Mm.
And
what made you reach that? How did you reach that conclusion?
Well, I had reached that conclusion when I found out that it was possible to have a livelihood when doing things you like to do. That's really what it came down to. In other words, I had now abandoned the notion that you had to be a practically oriented individual, dealing with the things about you and making things and manufacturing things, that there was a room for a person who wanted to learn and who could contribute to scholarly activities. There was a place for such people, and I said, why not work for such a place? And that's what I did. In other words, I had gained confidence simply from having a certain amount of association, a certain amount of nudging from my older sister and her husband, that yes, these things can be achieved. And so I shifted to the pure chemistry curriculum. Now, incidentally, I also had a real strong bent toward physics and mathematics, but I knew in this hierarchy of how you could get work, chemistry was perhaps a little better than these others even. You see, all the time I was subject to this realization that I had to make a go of life.
Well, the depression was on too.
Oh, yes, and I'll tell you more about that presently, because there's the depression was starting, and then my junior year I had the pleasure of taking a course from a fellow by the name of George Glockter, who was very much interested in research in physical chemistry, and also did very well indeed in organic chemistry in understanding the subject. But I was not good in the laboratory. I was never really good in the laboratory. And organic chemistry, you had to be something of a skillful cook, you know, and The instrumentation wasn't all that it was now, and I didn't have that knack. Though the chief of the organic chemistry division at Minnesota thought I should become an organic chemist, Mr. Glockler thought it was fine that I wanted to become a physical chemist. So at any rate, I decided I'd go into physical chemistry. I did like physics, I liked mathematics, and this was now the shift I had made from the chemistry toward this intermediate area. Well, I talked to Glockler about graduate work, and he was pleased, of course, to discuss the alternatives with me, and he suggested I apply at various schools, and I did indeed apply to several places, including Caltech, applied to Princeton, I forgot where else, but at any rate, I got an offer of an assistantship at Caltech. Now, this was in 1933. The Depression was really hard. Unemployment was very high indeed. And in my graduating class, practically nobody got a job. I think there was one student who got a job of the chemistry majors. That's really depressing when you... I don't think people have any concept of the depth of that depression. However, I was offered this assistantship at Caltech, and they would provide room and board and $100 for the year, not a month. I have to stipulate that. You start saying $100 a month, well, maybe you could scrape by. $100 for the year was my stipend, but and I accepted. Incidentally, you may ask, you may say, well, in your letter, you didn't say, what about your experience at Caltech? I want to deal with this because this is rather. I think it was very important in my life. I went there, and with a letter of introduction to Linus Pauling, I talked with him and got to work in his group. Actually, although big science had not yet developed as we know it today, where you have, teams where the senior professor is boss and he's got a bunch of postdocs who tell the graduate students what to do, it was already started there. My immediate supervisor was a postdoc named Lawrence Brockway, who got his degree from Linus. And Linus was the professor in charge, but Brockway was telling me and a couple of others what we were supposed to be doing. That was my first exposure to what was the beginning of a what you call the organized research in a university, but it was done without recourse to a National Science Foundation or things like that. There were just some organizations like the Guggenheim and Rockefeller and a few others. Foundations would give support. I forgot who supported Pauling, but he did get certain support because he was such a remarkable individual. Well, I couldn't make a go of it financially, and I was reluctant to borrow more money and ask my parents, who had supported me, not to the point where they'd buy me a car or anything like that. I mean, let's face it, this was a rough time, and I was fully aware of the financial plight of my parents at the time. In retrospect, I should have borrowed more money, and somehow or other, and continued at Caltech. Nevertheless, I returned, and I got a job at University of Minnesota. They knew me, and they gave me an assistantship there, and I could live at home, and this worked out all right. But there's a little aspect to this Caltech business, a couple of interesting stories. It was very enlightening to me. I got my first exposure to quantum mechanics from Pauling, who taught the course, and he was a great teacher. Learned some more about thermodynamics from a fellow named Dickinson, and took a course in the first of of course, in special relativity from Richard Tolman. And Tolman was perhaps the greatest teacher I had up to that time. He was phenomenal when it came to explaining things in a manner where you had a clear idea as to what was done. He could put things in simple form to show where the essence of things were. In the case of special relativity, the mathematics is not hard. It's simple algebra. The concepts, what do you mean when you do this? This is what you have to really address. He had the capacity to get you to see what the meaning was of the things. And the difficulties that people associate with it is not because the mathematics is hard, it's because just exactly what's doing what here. You see, this is the and that's what Tolman was able to do. And this was in the spring quarter. I had already committed myself to return to Minnesota, and then I began to have second thoughts. I said, geez, with a guy like this, why was I such a damn fool as not to make every effort to stay on and continue the and hear the next three quarters on general relativity from this man? However, that was water over the dam now. But now,
you did get a paper with Brockway, though.
Oh, yes, I did. And I could have, and this is what I was going to explain. I could have had a master's degree, and for some reason or other, I did not. I didn't want the master's degree. I wanted to work for a doctorate, which I ultimately did at Minnesota. But I would indicate in my curriculum vitae and so on that I was a student at Caltech and things. But then some curious things happened. First of all, people said I had a master's degree from Caltech, which I didn't. Then I had to correct them because I wanted an honest statement. And then some people say, you know, Fred Waller looks like a pretty good student here. You know, I'd gone to Minnesota, but why couldn't he make the grade at Caltech? Is he any good, you know? Then I'd explain it the way he might, you know, raise their eyebrows. And so then I stopped saying I ever was at Caltech. I got to the point where as much as that experience was a good one for me, I didn't like to have to explain to people why I left. Why was I such a damned fool, see? And if I gave them the honest answer, they'd say, well, it's probably a rationalization, see, you know, an explanation. And as a matter of fact, I can tell you a little interesting story in that connection, which finally, well, by this time I was older. Subsequently, since my relations with Pauling were always good, I had occasion to introduce him at the dedication of the chemistry building at Santa Barbara. And I went up there and I introduced him, you know, and so forth. And Pauling got up and said, well, thank you, Fred, it's nice for your introduction. And he said to the group, I've known Fred Wall for a number of years, and, you know, he was one of our failures. Jeez, I could have sunk right to the floor. And there's tittering in the audience. Then Linus said, oh, I don't mean to say he failed. I mean, we failed. We failed to provide the conditions that would have kept him at Caltech. But for that instant,
I can imagine.
Well, you know, well, when you reflect on it, Linus wouldn't have done that to anybody, mm-hmm. See. It was a kind of a joke, but at the moment, you can see
absolutely
how I felt, especially in light of, you know, this experience.
Yes.
And he says, one of our failures. I don't mean he failed. Then that quieted off the group, and I felt a hell of a lot better than everybody else. But that was a kind of a one of those practical jokes that sometimes gets you a little. So